Hello and welcome back to the Third Period Podcast, where we take a look at the UK's ice hockey leagues. We're sponsored by Willie's Ice Hockey Emporium for all your ice hockey needs. Check them out.
Good evening, everyone, and a very happy new year to you all, and welcome back to another episode of the Third Period Podcast. Did you all like the new intro that we've put at the start? We seem to enjoy it, and thank you to Willie's Ice Hockey Emporium for joining up with us. So, as always, you got myself, Danny, and tonight I have Ash. Ash, how are you?
Very good, thank you, Danny. Happy New Year to you.
Thank you. Happy New Year to you too, Ash. We have Scott. Scott, how are you?
Still struggling from the festivities, but all good.
It's good to hear. And Ross over in the cave. Did you get a new Wi-Fi router for your Christmas present, Ross?
Yeah, I did. He brought it. It came down the chimney, and hopefully we're all good this year. So, but yeah, I'm all good, thanks. Danny, how are you?
I am good, thank you very much. I've probably put a stone back on after losing the four before Christmas, but it gives me something to work towards. So let's introduce tonight's guest. So we're rolling back the years here for the Blaze fans. We're going back to the most successful year in the club's history from the time in Coventry. A signing that, from what we understand, very nearly didn't happen, but we'll get onto that a little bit later on. We're certainly grateful that it did happen, though, as he went on to win not only a Challenge Cup and Elite League title, but also ended with a playoff winner's medal. We welcome Canadian forward and Blaze Grand Slam winner, Chris McNamara. Chris, thank you for joining us. How are you this evening?
I'm great, guys. Thanks for having me.
No, it's our pleasure. It is our pleasure.
Great intro, by the way.
Thank you. We thank Ash for that one. He does all the stats and the Wikipedia.
Okay. Thank you, Ash.
So I'll get the old adage question out of the way. So ice hockey for yourself, what's your first memory?
Oh, geez. My backyard rink, I guess. Living in northern Canada, there's no lack of cold weather, snow, ice. And my father always built a backyard rink in our backyard and opened it up to the neighborhood. So my first recollection is not playing hockey on that rink, but skating as fast as I can across the rink and jumping headfirst into the snowbanks. And so that's my actual first recollection. I have three brothers, so we did that more than we played hockey the first couple of years.
Well, so that just explains why you're pretty nifty on your skates then. I mean, we always remembered you and you were pretty rapid. So we're going to start off, you had a couple of seasons in the Ontario Junior Hockey League with the Newmarket Hurricanes. Yeah, yes. Top point scorer in your second season, 138 points in 95 games. That's pretty good going. What was the experience like for yourself?
Newmarket, where I played, it was the city I played in, was for me really where I thought there was an opportunity for me to be able to play maybe beyond junior hockey. So I was a late bloomer, as they say. I didn't get to the size and stature I was until much later than my peers. So I was, you know, 17, 18 years old, and I was still growing. Actually, funny story, my first training camp, I was 16 turning 17. And junior in Canada, you're playing against anywhere from a 17-year-old to a 21-year-old. So big gap. And in the spring, I went to a rookie camp for that particular team, and I was 5'11", almost 6 feet tall. And I came back in the fall, and I was 6'3". So that gives you an idea of how much I grew and how awkward I was for a period of time. But it really was my launching pad. The first year I had to pay my dues. I had to get my fair share of fights because I was a big guy, and then got more and more ice time. And then by my third year, I was starting to get a lot of interest from Division I schools in the United States, and I'm starting to really see that there might be a future for me to play hockey beyond junior.
Oh, wow. So also, you played with Jeff Hutchins, another Blaze player in Newmarket as well. What was that like?
Well, Jeff is a wild man. He was an absolute wild man when I first met him. So we actually traded for him, if my memory serves me correctly. And he came in as a pretty tough goal-scoring winger, but came in and made an impression right away because he would fight anybody in the league. And he was fighting at a rapid pace. We needed him to score, but he came in and just started to settle in with five-minute majors. So I remember him just being a wild, crazy guy. And then he started to get out of that and started to be a real, real impact player for us. And then when I played with him that 1 year, and when we went our separate ways, he went down to a university in the States. And then after my first year with the Blaze, Tomo came to me and said, "Hey, do you know this Jeff? I know that you know this Jeff Hutchins guy. What do you think?" And this was going back a ways now, right? Because I already played 4 years of college, 2 years of pro, and I was over in Coventry. So six years or so had gone by. And all I could remember is that he was super tough, go up and down the wing and score goals. And that's all I really said to Tomo. And sure enough, I checked in the following year and he was there.
Well, Jeff Hutchins has been around ever since. He's still around in Fife. He was at the end of last season on the bench. So
is he? Wow.
He came over and never left. He's had a bit of a tour of Great Britain with a few different clubs, and he's found his feet in Fife. You obviously mentioned about a little bit on college there, and you went to the NCAA for four seasons with Lake Superior State University. Was the NCAA always the route you're going to follow?
No, it's a funny story on that too. As a kid in Canada, you basically want to play major junior hockey, which is the OHL, the WHL, the QMJHL. And for me, being an Ontario resident, I wanted to play in the OHL. I actually went to a training camp as a 16-year-old and was offered a card on the team to play on the team. And it was in my local city in Barrie, Ontario. And my mother is a teacher and an academic. And she said, "There is no way you're going that route. Because if you go the OHL route, you basically forfeit any ability to get a Division I scholarship. You declare your status as non-amateur." So I quickly realized the route I was going to be forced to go, even though I wanted to play major junior. And luckily, I was able to kind of combine hockey and school. And it allowed me to get that full scholarship. Now, if I look back, given the time and the signing bonuses and the national hockey level and the types of guys that were getting drafted, they're looking for big, strong guys. Do I wish maybe that I had gone that way? I mean, hindsight's 20/20, but probably would have fit my game a bit better than the NCAA. My game was fairly physical up and down, and NCAA, to be fair, is a great brand of hockey, but more X's and O's, not as physical. Obviously, there's none of the fighting. So kind of you can lose an element of your game when you go the NCAA route.
Obviously, last season in the NCAA, you obviously knew that your game was there and you got to captain the team. Mm-hmm. So what were you expecting at the end of the NCAA? Obviously, you went to the East Coast Hockey League and you ended up mm-hmm. going into the AHL. What were you expecting at the end? And
good question. I had no idea what I was going to do. I knew that I wanted to continue to play hockey, and I wanted to give the professional level a go. And what I told myself is, I'm going to give it 2 years and see what happens. And so I did what most guys do when they're thinking about going to pro hockey. I found myself an agent. I found an agent that I liked, and he got me my first tryout at an NHL camp. And so right out of my last year at Lake State, I went to a Pittsburgh Penguins camp. And that was just for me, it was a dream come true. I was on the ice with Mario Lemieux and Alexei Kovalev and Alexander Degg and, you know, all these guys that I'd grown up watching, and had to almost pinch myself that I was actually there and on the ice with them. But it was a great experience. And so once the way it works at the pro level is you try out, And then if you don't make the cut, you go down to the farm team and you try out there. So then I went down to Wilkes-Barre in the AHL and then ended up in the East Coast. I was really relatively unknown prospect, was undrafted to the NHL. So I knew I was going to have to work my way through the ranks to give myself a chance. And I was prepared to do it. I was just happy. Hey, I was 23 and getting paid to play hockey, a game I'd play for free. So for me, it was fantastic. And at that NHL camp, I'll never forget. First of all, Mary Lemieux was like an absolute star. He went around to every player in the locker room, said his hellos, because he knew that's what the players, you know, were probably looking for. So showed a big leadership role there. And then my first exhibition game with Pittsburgh, we all get on the bus and we're going off to the game, and Meryl Lemieux and Alexei Kovalev aren't on the bus, but they're supposed to play. So the coach is asking the manager, where are these guys? What are they doing? They're late. And he said, they'll be there. Alexei and Mario took their own plane. And Alexei Kovalev's flying the plane. It's his plane. And he's the pilot of the plane. So that's my story. They met us at the game in their plane as we took the bus, and they played the game and flew back.
Wow. Only they could get away with doing something like that, I suppose. It has to be.
Yeah. Oh. It was pretty rock star.
Yeah, just a tad. So you mentioned, obviously, playing the exhibition with the Pittsburgh Penguins. You've had a couple of years then after that in the ECHL, the AHL, with the Laulock Monsters, I want to say, and then correct, the Wheeling Nailers. I believe the Wheeling Nailers, obviously, are the ECHL affiliate to the farm team in the AHL. Yes. Those leagues back then, would you say they were a lot tougher than they are now?
Yeah, I think the game in general has just changed a lot. Even though, well, it doesn't feel like I played that long ago, but it's going on 16 years, and the game has changed a lot. It's all now about speed and skill. And before, there was plenty of speed and skill, but you always had, you know, that third, fourth line, those, you know, fifth, sixth defensemen that were going to carry the load physically. Lots of routine fighting. There's always a couple of tough guys, so to speak, on your team. A lot more stick work and hacking and whacking, a lot more general obstruction in the game. And so it was far more physical from that end. And being a big guy, you're always going to be challenged and expected to fight. And the other part about that is a lot of people get away with hacking and whacking and hooking and holding bigger guys. So your body takes a toll over 85 games. I mean, when we were in the East Coast, we were playing 3 games in 4 nights, and it was a grind. You know, it was a glorified bus league, and you really earned your keep in those days. So the game's changed. I think the game changed for the better, to be perfectly honest. I love seeing all the skill come through and all the speed. And, you know, the odd fight is great. I still believe that it polices the game to some degree and doesn't allow it to get too out of hand. But the need or demand for the so-called tough guy these days is less and less. It's becoming a position, at least at the professional level, that's no longer a requirement. And to find a guy that can do both is very difficult, right? So, like, there's only a select few I can think of in the NHL that can play and bring on that physical element, that fighting element as well.
Definitely, 100%. And you can see that with the way the league's going all over the world now.
In the UK now? I'm curious. Is it changed in the UK since we were there? Is there still quite a bit of rough and tough stuff? What would you guys say?
I'd say there's a hell of a lot less fights. It's a precarious one. There's the odd fight here and there, but I think the stage fights have well and truly gone by the wayside. And when you do get the odd fight, it's a late hit, a bad check, a dirty play, and it's someone stepping up for a teammate rather than, well, back in your time over here where two guys looked each other in the face after and went, yeah, let's go and have 5 minutes. It's changed truly since then. Now we've touched on coming to Coventry. Well, as you know, we're all Blaze fans and you played a big part in us having probably the most successful time of our time in Coventry. But how does this deal come about for you to come to Coventry? Because at the time you were a decent East Coast AHL player, getting decent games, decent minutes, and then you're in the UK.
Yeah. Yeah, it's actually, no one really knows the background story very well. So I had played 2 years. I played the majority of my first 2 years in the American League, finished the back end of my first year, and then played almost the entire season the following year. And then, I don't know if you guys recall, but there was a lockout in the NHL that 2004-05 season. And what happened in that season is all these young players that were on one-way NHL contracts came down to the American League to stay in shape, and they played the year there. So I went from a pretty serviceable player in the American League quickly to being kind of a fourth line limited ice time player for that year, because they were bringing down first round picks and second round picks and very good players, to their credit, but kind of forced me out to some degree. I actually went and got a job at a bank that summer, and I was thinking to myself, I have a finance background. I'm thinking, well, maybe this is what I should do. I'll go get a taste of it and see what it's all about. So I was, for all intents and purposes, retired. I got married in June, end of June that year. And my wife and I, Anne, were kind of just going about our business. She just got a new job in pharmaceutical sales, and we were both working. And I got a call from an agent, Gary Pryor, and he said, hey, listen, I know you've got your undergrad, but is there any interest in getting your MBA for free? And going and playing a little hockey overseas. And so that's what actually originally piqued my interest. And I ran it by my wife, and we just got married, and I was contemplating see you later for the year, because she wasn't going to leave her newly found job. And she was very supportive. She said, listen, like, getting your MBA is important. It's going to help us get ahead. She knew it was something I wanted to do at some point. I still had an itch to play. I was still training like I was maybe going to play. And what I learned a little later is they actually had their eyes on a player by the name of Eric Bedoin, who is a very good player in the American League as well. And he was an Andre Payette connection to Tomo. And it fell through last minute. He either had a contractual obligation to stay back or something, or he just got cold feet. Wanted to give the AHL another crack for a year. And that's what opened the opportunity for me. So I quickly, ramped up my training because I wasn't in game shape, and went and got my visa and at the Canadian Embassy in Ottawa. And about three and a half, four weeks later, I was on a plane to Coventry. So I had one conversation with Tomo. I knew nobody on the team. I showed up. A couple of funny stories showing up. I show up. We're going to Belfast, and so before I know it, I'm at this airport on the tarmac, and I'm getting into literally this model airplane. It didn't look like it could hold three of us, and we're all crammed into this plane, and I'm thinking, we're going down. There's no way this plane's taking off with all of our gear and all of these big guys in. Sure enough, we get up in the air. We're going down. The wind's howling. We're landing in Belfast. And I can see the runway in and out of my eyesight, because I can see right down the aisle of the plane. I can see out the front windshield. And the runway is just going in and out of my sight. And I'm thinking, we're not landing this thing. I'm going to die, and I haven't even played a game. And sure enough, we landed, and that was my first game. I got dropped off. When I first got to the airport, I was picked up by, I believe it was Brooksy, and dropped me off at an apartment. And who's my first roommate? Andre Payette. So, I mean, his name, I don't need to really say much more, but let's just say that I was used to fairly domesticated living. And he was not. So I basically I ended up living with a caged animal for a little bit of time. until, and I love the guy, don't get me wrong, but I went to Tom after about a week and I said, Tom, I can't do this. Like I'm happy to live with somebody, no problem, but this guy's an animal. And so he actually moved Andre out and Neil Martin came in and we got along famously and still are friends today. But that's the story. That's my first week or a few days in Coventry.
I think if anyone gets offered a trade of Neil Martin for Andre Payet, I think everyone's taking that trade in all senses.
So you get it. So you guys. All
yeah, I think 99 out of 100 would take it. Maybe Andre wouldn't. But what was your first impressions of the Sky Dome and Coventry itself?
Oh, I loved it. Little town, which was fine with me. The rink itself, I thought was. It was very similar, like a junior rink in Canada. And then, to be honest, I was impressed right away with the hockey to a certain level. I was expecting it to be perhaps a little weaker than what I was accustomed to. But the level of play was quite good, and especially on a man-to-man basis on our team. We were pretty lucky. We had some really great players. And so my first thoughts were good hockey, better than expected. And to be fair, I was shocked with the fan support. That's one thing that was a real pleasant surprise. I mean, I recall almost always having a full rink, packed house. And I remember, I loved the fact that people were using it as a social gathering, drinking beer, hooting, hollering, the singing, which never happens, right, in a Canadian rink. That real football atmosphere or soccer here in North America was super cool. And again, it didn't hurt that we had a stacked team and we knew we were going to win most of our games going into them. Yeah.
I think we've just touching on your comment about Eric Bedoin. So you're the reason why he was always mentioned in the Rumorville for 15 years after his Neil signing. It was like, oh, we're signing Eric Bedoin this year. It never happened. But
it never did happen, did it?
We finally found out the reason.
There it is. I think he just felt he couldn't do it justice after I took his role. I think that's what it was. He was some cold feet. I'm just kidding. Yeah. I don't know him. I don't know him personally, but I knew he knew Andre pretty well. So maybe Andre was funneling that myth. I'm not sure.
Maybe he heard he had to room with Andre if he came over and that put him off.
that put anybody off.
You heard it here first, everybody. That's the reason that Bedoin didn't come and join the Blaze.
can't say that I blame him.
So, no. Chris, on your topic of rinks that we've kind of touched upon with Skydome there, you must have had a real eye-opener with some of the rinks that you ended up visiting as a... obviously. Play squad that year. So we had the crossover cup, so we were playing the teams in the lower division. Some of those rinks were not probably anywhere near the standard of the Skydome, let alone a North American style rink. Even London, who were in the Elite League, their rink must have been a big shock to the system. What was your first thoughts when you went into those types of rinks? Did you think, what am I playing tonight?
Yeah, 100% I thought that. So did everybody else that ever played there. So when I went, I mean, my first game was in Belfast, gorgeous rink, right? Like really, really beautiful rink, probably the nicest one in the league. So I had like a false expectation to some degree. And then I show up at places like London and I'm dressing in a hangar and an airplane hangar and moms and kids are walking by while I'm standing there in my jock and you know, Layman's got this like Lycra full body suit on. He's shaped like a milk bag. And so he's got, and people and fans are walking by and like, no, like full disclosure. And so that was an experience and it was like playing in a little war zone, little shoebox. And then Cardiff was pretty cool because it was nostalgic, but we always had, as you guys know, we always had some pretty heated battles there, small ice surface. lots of tough guys on both teams. Those always got out of hand. We went up to Fife, and I believe a couple years before we got there, there was a metal pole right down the middle of the ice that actually went from the roof and supported the roof down to the ice. It was an interesting barn. But the reality is in Canada growing up, you're used to these small community centers and things that are dated. And for me, it was just all about hanging out with the guys and winning some hockey games, you know, like for the way I always describe my time at Coventry, which I look back on really fondly, is, you know, it was like a full year guys golf trip, you know, like it was a guys trip for a full year. It was one of the best years of my life. We all got along famously. We won a lot of hockey games. We had fun doing it. And it was like a big getaway with the boys. So that's the way I look at it.
It's definitely fond memories for ourselves in the chaps. Obviously, it was a very winning year, lots of trophies, and it sounds just the same for the players as well. And that's great to hear. But mm-hmm. during your time with Coventry and coming away from the abundance of rinks you've came across, a stat I found out the other day, which I was a bit shocked by. Well, not shocked, it's probably not the best word, but you were the top point scorer for the Blaze on the power play. Now, normally the power play struggled, and you and that team was stacked. You had Neil Martin, we've already mentioned, Dan Carlson, Adam Calder. Them guys scored points for fun. But you came from that niche role back in North America of being a third-line penalty-killing guy. Now you're a power play star. How was that transition for yourself?
Good question. I mean, I was always offensively minded in all the leagues and levels as I grew up, and I always was a producer, but I was still earning my stripes in the American League. So you do start usually in a role where, you know, you gotta play that physical role, show that you're defensively reliable and do all these things before you're given true opportunity. And probably just because the lockout wasn't there long enough, I believe at some point I would have been put in a situation to play in those power plays and a little more ice time. But with respects to the power play in Coventry, I was really lucky. I fell into it, right? Tomo was great with me. He had a lot of faith in me, and he gave me tons of opportunity, even though clearly our number one line was the Carlson Calder duo. Like there's no displacing them, nor did I want to. I wanted to be a good supportive role to their offense. And when, you know, they weren't able to carry the mail on a specific night, our lines were, and so were the guys on in the third line as well. So with respects to the power play, Tomo put me in a great spot where we had this breakout where I would just come around behind and pick up the puck, and then Neil Martin would actually go in front of me and almost present as a pick in any oncoming traffic. So it gave me a direct lane to carry the puck all the way down the ice and set up on the half wall. And then at that stage, it was easy to get points because I was playing with all these skilled guys. You had, to your point, you had Neil Martin at any given moment. On the other point, you had Dougie Schuler, Wade Bielak, or a forward of some kind. And then I had Calder, Carlson, Ashley Tate. Like I had many options, and then when it was time to shoot, I could come off the wall and shoot. So for me, we could just pick apart penalty kills, and when the opportunity presented itself, you had to shoot or make a pass. And really, I credit the guys. I mean, I didn't even know that stat, by the way, number one. But our power play was on fire that year, and it was really just because there was a lot of offensive upside on the team. It was easy to play on. You know, and Tom will put me out in a lot of situations. So that was good.
I mean, that team was just definitely stacked, wasn't it, from top to bottom? So you win the first trophy in Coventry, in the second leg burner against Cardiff in the Challenge Cup. Obviously, you didn't finish that game after a melee between Adam Calder and Rob Davison as you got third man in. But what was the game like for you?
It was wild. It was wild. And just to go back, just quickly, I want to answer that, but I want to give credit where credit's due with the boys. So talking about team depth, I think our third line didn't get enough credit that year, and our fifth and sixth defensemen. So we had the strongest British players in the league. I'm convinced of it. Man for man, we had Ashley Tate, Tommy Watkins, Russ Cowley, and then Peasy on the back end. And we had compliments like Graham Schlender, right, in between Watkins and Cowley. Those guys carried the mail a lot for us, right? And they put in hard miles on the ice. Like, Schlems was fighting, and they were scoring goals. And the days where we didn't score goals, they would pick up the slack. And our Brits played a big role and played a lot of minutes. And when I think about that Cardiff match, Tommy Watkins, I believe, won that game for us, scoring one or two big goals because there was no one left to play on the bench. We showed up. There were bodyguards. Is this the game? Have I got this one right? There were bodyguards.
Yeah.
Okay. There were bodyguards there because they were trying to intimidate us, I think. I'm not sure what the goal was, but they had these guys that looked like they lived in a ditch together. And I just got off the bottle, and they're all standing there. They're these Neanderthals, like these massive guys. And they wouldn't let us go kind of from our locker room or dressing room up to the ice until warm-ups. And so we were all having a good laugh in the room. I think that's one thing that people don't understand is we took our games very lightly. Like, when it was time to play and compete, we had the most competitive group of guys, man for man, I can think of. But leading up to the games, like, we were joking around. We were lighthearted. It was lots of fun. So much so that Tomo would get really worried that we weren't going to be ready to play until about 2 minutes before the game, and then we'd kind of get it together. But that game was wild. It just got out of hand. They were trying to intimidate us, and we just didn't have a team that would back down. I mean, again, we had tons of toughness with the addition of Bielak. Made everybody, you know, a few inches taller, a few pounds heavier. And we had him and, you know, Schlens and lots of guys that were willing to play that physical role. And the guys did, and we never backed down. And, you know, sometimes things happen and heat of the moment. And I believe I did get that third man in. I think there was half of our bench by the end of the game. Wild game. Marty got hurt, I think, that game. And so, you know, it was crazy and wild, but still showed our ability to kind of persevere, I think, and still able to pull it out with our depth. I think I want to go back to the depth was huge for us. We had a lot of stars, but we also had a lot of guys that played massive roles that went unsung. And those are the guys that carried us through those games.
Yeah, I mean, some of the players that we had was, you know, they didn't get the credit they deserved. But am I right in thinking that you were late getting into the rink because of these Neanderthals or whatever you want to call them?
Yeah, these mongoloids. Yeah, I don't think they let us in the rink until like almost just before warm-ups. There was something, this is a long time ago, but they were doing everything they could to make sure we were off our game, essentially, and making it hard on us. And I don't think they let any of the fans in, right? No fans were allowed in until just before puck drop or something. I can't recall. Yeah.
Yeah, that's it.
And it was great though. It made for a great atmosphere. Honestly, we relished it. Like the boys loved it, right? The more physical, the more emotion. I just would really up a lot of games. Another guy, like, huge gamer. You wouldn't think, being such a prolific scorer, is Calder. Like, that guy had the shortest fuse. And if you made him mad, he was better. So, to their detriment, right? Most times when you made him mad, he'd slash you first, and then he might fight you, but then he'd probably score a couple goals. So it was a lose-lose-lose in most instances, right? So we just had that mindset in our team. I don't know why. It was just the right complement of guys, but every guy to a man was just there to compete, and we didn't really get off our game very much or really rarely. Yeah.
So was it the first trophy that you won in your career, was it?
Let me think. I did a lot of winning in junior. So in junior, we won a lot. We had very strong teams in Newmarket. But at the pro level, that was the first trophy I'd won. And not understanding the format of the English Elite League and these several trophies and Challenge Cup, and there was a lot of hardware at stake. So it was nice always having these goals to go after, right? Like throughout the season, rather than just one main one at the end of the season, which is what we're used to in North America. So I enjoyed it. Little mini playoff series, almost a little mini tournaments, and they really kept the competition level up.
Obviously, that was the start of the trophy hall in Coventry. And then number two is the league title. Did you have to be explained 400 times that the league was the main title that season?
Yes,
I think obviously a lot of people struggle with it, but it must have been the toughest. But for us, I mean, I love it. I love it as it being the main title, because the team has to turn up every night. And it's not you bag a playoff place and you can relax a little, play some of the guys. It's night in, night out. But from your standpoint, how was it?
Yeah, well, you're right. I didn't appreciate it, right? Because I didn't know it. And you're just trying to make playoffs in North America, just for the listeners to understand. I mean, all you're trying to do in North America is get to a stage where you're in a high enough grouping that you get to the playoffs. And playoffs is where everything happens. And there's one thing you can win at the end of the year, which is, you know, in the NHL, it's obviously the Stanley Cup, but there's always a trophy to be won. But I was lucky. I was in our dressing room. I was put beside Ashley Tate for the year just by coincidence. But he would give me all the info I needed, right? Being a seasoned British hockey player, he'd let me know the importance, and I could sense the importance once he let me know in the stands. And it did make every game important, and we took it seriously, right? I mean, we, all joking aside, it was a goal of ours. We knew it had never been done. Once someone put it on our radar, and I'm not sure who actually put it on our radar, it could have been Tomo, that we had an opportunity here to do something unprecedented. It really got us going, right? It was something that we all as a group wanted to accomplish together. And knew we could.
How tough was it physically that season? Because at times we would get players chucked out, and then obviously some of the refs are a bit whistle happy at times with some of the members in our team. Did you struggle with that, or was it? I imagine you definitely did struggle. But what was it like?
Yeah, it was. Every hockey season's taxing. Now, what we had going for us in England was, you know, you played less games. So you play about 85 games in the regular season in the US. And so less games, but a lot of ice time. So we only have three lines in England. So we're used to having four lines as forwards. And Tomo played his top two lines a lot, I think, even as compared to other teams. And so we had so much ice time that, you know, it did get taxing. But in fairness to Tomo, Tomo's a great player's coach. And when we talk about player coaches, he really relates with the players, and he senses when guys need breaks, and he senses when guys are getting a little too worn out, and he'll you know, allow you to take it easy in a couple of practices, or maybe scale back a bit ice time. But it was certainly a taxing season. It was more physical than I thought it was going to be. I was thinking, you know, going over to play in Europe, that the common misnomer in Europe is that it's Olympic size ice and it's not as physical. But with the lockout, especially, we got all these tough guys that came in from NHL teams and American League teams and East Coast teams, and it added up probably an extra element of physicality. But it was taxing physically too. We had a lot of guys with bumps and bruises and injuries, right? But Tomo was good at getting guys the proper rest, and Nikki and the team there at the time that were doing all the physio were super awesome and got guys ready to play when they needed to play. But by the end of the year, we had a lot of tired guys, a lot of guys that came in probably, you know, at a certain weight camp, left probably 10, 15, maybe 20 pounds lighter. So there was a lot of fatigue by the end of the year, for sure.
I can only imagine it was pretty bearing on the body, especially when you've done the Challenge Cup, you've done the league, and then that's it. Full focus goes towards getting that third and final trophy and completing the, you know, Grand Slam. So when obviously the league's tied up, is it Tomo brings you back in, you have your celebrations, but then it's very much next day, right, league's focus now, let's prep for that. Let's go for the playoffs.
Yeah, it was always that. And again, like Tomo was good that way too. He knew when he could say, hey, okay, I'm going to take the reins off and let you guys go and do your thing. And that was great because we needed to do that. And we wanted to do it, and but we had to pick our spots. And so he was really good at allowing us to do that. And we loved hanging out and blowing off some steam. But it really was kind of, you know, enjoy for a moment in time and let's get back to work. And that was our mentality. We did, like I said, at that point, it was very much in our minds that we were going to do something that hadn't been done. And we really wanted to accomplish it. And it was a huge goal. And we had no problem going back to work ever. I can't recall a time where guys didn't want to go to practice and work and put the work in. So we just went back to work and had a one track mind to go and have some success and put our best foot forward. And that was it.
Yeah. So you mentioned there, obviously, having about like a one track mind and the focus. I suppose the question for you, Chris, is in your mind, obviously, you had a decision that you were making at the end of that season that we now know, which is obviously you were going to retire and step away from the sport. Did that have any kind of hindrance when you played, or did you kind of just put it to the back of the mind, focus on what was at hand, and then have that decision later?
Yeah, I knew it was in all likelihood my last year, and I was going to do it on my own terms. But I'd have to say it probably didn't impact me. And it was just because that game was so important that we really just had that one track mind. That's all I was really thinking about. Even as we won, I don't recall thinking, oh, that was my last game. I was just more excited and happy about the win and wanted to enjoy it with the guys. And so for me, it was just leaving on such a high note, right? And on my own terms, like I said, that I have no qualms. I've got no regrets. Was it hard on me to not want to come back because of the guys and the positive experience? 100%. But I also knew that, you know, I'm just finishing my MBA. I've got a wife at home. We want to start a family. I had other career aspirations beyond hockey. And I was prepared to go and, you know, start that chapter of my life. I left in great terms. And have zero regrets about my departure.
Looking at that decision that you did made and back then, but the Elite League was nowhere near the standard it was now, say. It was quite a small fish in the big pond of European hockey, and a lot of the top end players were getting poached by European teams with more money, bigger stadiums. You've made the decision to step away from the sport and start a family and move into the real world, if the phrase. How was that conversation with Tomo and your teammates that season? So I assume some would have been going, we want you back. Come back for another year. Let's win more trophies.
Yeah, it was, that part was tough. Tomo definitely expressed his interest in having me back, which I appreciate. I was flattered by. The teammates were probably the tougher because we had this period of time where I was still finishing my MBA and we were done, and all the guys were still hanging out, and a lot of them were taking goes at me to try to see if they could convince me to stay for another year. And it was tough, right? Because it was so positive that certainly it was something that was enticing, I would say. But at the end of the day, my decision was made, and I knew that it was the right time for me. A lot of guys would say that it was probably premature. I think I was only 25. I think I was 25. And so I still had a lot of hockey in me. I think that's what people saw. And, but for me, I really wanted to get ahead of my career aspirations. That was important to me. I didn't want to enter the workforce, you know, when I was 40 or in my late 30s. And I was thankful for everything hockey gave me at that stage. I didn't feel like, you know, I was missing out too much. I enjoyed my time, and again, I got to leave on that note, so there's nothing better than that.
So let's go back to hockey. The playoffs are in full swing. We're head-to-head with London Racers in the Sky Dome. Andre gets up to, should we say, Andre things. Next minute, there's a bench-clearing brawl. What's going through your mind when you're watching the likes of Wade Belak and Eric Cairn centre-ice?
Wasn't that a wild scene? First of all, I thought the ref was going to get punched, I think, for a second there, because he was skating all around the ice. And then Russ Cowley took a punch, I think, from Eric Cairns, maybe.
Yes, definitely.
And he was an innocent bystander. And I don't know, for whatever reason, all of us found that really funny that he took a shot at Russ Cowley. Russ looking, you know, Russ with his open deer eyes, wondering what happened. And then the two heavyweights squared off. To be honest, I'm glad that Andre didn't have to fight him, because that was even above his weight class. And going on to Wade, I mean, Wade, when he came in, I think he came in mid, late November. He was a huge element to our success. You know, when you think about, we were already tough in winning games, but you add that, and then you pair him with Marty, and Marty was playing 35 minutes a game. And so he was getting a lot of abuse, right? And as soon as Wade came, Marty had a lot more freedom. Guys were reluctant to rough up Marty because they knew the consequences of doing so. So Wade was a big piece. He freed up some of our guys that logged ice time. He strangely would accept any fight from anybody. It's just ingrained in him because he has no reason to fight some of these guys he was fighting, but he'd give everyone their shot. And then Eric Cairns, for the listeners that don't know, he was a bona fide heavyweight in the NHL. Well, Wade was a bona fide heavyweight in the NHL. So these guys are career enforcers and know what they're doing. And so I was just more interested in seeing how it was going to play out, right? Like, at that stage, I'm a fan with you guys. We're watching this, and I'm like, this is the gate. Let's go. Ring the bell. And wow, was it a fight. And Wade got the better of him, I feel. And it was just another team-building moment for us. All these things, it's funny. All these things happened at the Cardiff and that huge fight and all this mayhem. But we always seem to come on the upper hand on most of them, I think. They just were building blocks for our team. Like, we just built off them, fed off them. It was great. And we loved it, right? We all went back to the room, had a few beers, laughed, told the stories. You know, it was great. It was a gong show, but it was a lot of fun to be a part of.
That night, it was, well, I had college the next day and my mum was picking me up and she's messaging me going, what time's this game finished? Like, it's like 10:30. I was like, oh, well, not my fault, but you know, what a wild night. Obviously we get to the final four weekend. We beat Sheffield in the semi-final before going on to play the host Nottingham, which is tough to do because it's their home rink. We take it to overtime. Only for Ashley Tate to create history.
Mm-hmm.
What was that moment like for yourself?
It was awesome. You know, I have to be honest. I did not expect to be going into overtime. We were all so confident going into that game. We thought if we play the way we know we can, we're gonna have our way with them. But to their credit, they had the crowd behind them. They played a solid defensive game, and I was actually just making a line change as Ashley was screaming down the wing, and I was getting on the bench as he was about to make that pump fake on the defenseman and the goalie, and he kind of made the goalie kind of sit on his skates and then pushed it a little further, and as we all know, slid it in, and I got to see that final piece. And we are just thrilled, right? A sense of relief too, because to lose that game would have been really tough for us because we were so accustomed to winning. We were so close to doing something other people had not, or other teams had not done. Would have been super disappointing not to finish it off. But on a couple of levels, like just pure relief, but exuberance, excitement, really happy for Ashley, and I'm really happy for British hockey, right? Like, the story is so good in so many ways. couldn't happen to a better guy. I you know, Ashley is a tremendous player, was a tremendous player for us. And a really good quiet leader. People don't give him credit. I know he left and then came back at some point to Coventry, and it's been a bit of a tumultuous road to some degree from what I understand. But that year he was a really quiet, solid foundation for our team. You know, let us know how things were going to play out for the guys that had never been in the league, and spoke up when he needed to, and was always consistent, right? Always did his job, put points on the board, was reliable in all areas of the rink. And when he put that in, I was so happy for him, and then so happy for the team, and just such a great way for us to finish it off.
I think that you seem to speak so well of the people that were in that team that year, and the coach Tomo and that. Do you still keep in touch with the guys, or have you been able to watch the some of the history games that have been put up over the summer?
Yeah, I've been watching. I watched Tomo's podcast. I know Tomo had a podcast. I don't know if it was with you guys or not.
It was with the Blaze, yeah.
Yeah. I keep in touch with Tomo through text, and I keep in touch with Russ and Tommy Watkins. I went down, I made a point to go and visit Adam Calder when he was quite sick. And I was actually in the UK in London for business. And I took a train into Coventry, and we all got together. I think Danny Stewart, who I didn't play with, but he was there. Matthias Soderstrom was there. Ross Calds, Tommy Watkins, Peasy. We all had a good catch up. And, you know, I was able to spend some time with Adam, which was really important, selfishly for me. And I hope gave him some positivity for a period of time. But talk about a rough road that guy went down. And so we did keep in touch. I do keep in touch with some of the guys. Strangely, I hired, when I came back and started to work, I hired Neil Martin when he finished playing hockey. So he still works for the company I hired him in. And then Joel Poirier I hired, he came back and he moved to my hometown, our hometown. And Graham Schlender, who lives now out east, when I go out there, we visit with his family, and I keep in touch with him. And then since COVID came on, we actually have been better at keeping in touch. It kind of, because we all had a little more time on our hands, we got a little Zoom call together, and I got Lamer on there, Jody Lehman, and Schlenz, and Dougie Schuler, and a bunch of the guys, and we went down memory lane for a bit. So I don't keep in touch with all of them as much as I'd like. I know if we all got together for whether it be a reunion or whatever, we'd pick up right where we left off. There's no question there.
I'm glad you got to spend time with Adam, because obviously that hit us all hard, but I can imagine the guys he was in the room with, it would have hurt them a lot more than anyone else. And obviously you must have had some good stories in that year. Is there anyone, any stories that you could share that we could put out on this podcast? Yeah. Obviously there's going to be a few that we can't, but
yeah. Well, there's, where do I start, I guess, but, and 98% of them are about Andre Payette, but, we had the best team dynamic. No one took themselves too seriously. There weren't a lot of egos, to be honest. I mean, there are egos on a professional team, but guys were pretty self-deprecating. Right. So we were able to take the piss out of each other all the time. And we always took the piss out of Andre. So he couldn't even come into our change room without us being just all over him. Peasy the most. Peasy would start it. And then we'd all climb on board, and it would always end up with Andre walking out the room and slamming the door and going and talking to Tomo like a child. And then he'd come back with his head down, and we'd pick him back up, and he'd be fine. Couple of good stories. Let's see. I got my favorite story, although it's not really that much hockey related, is we were all having a few drinks out on a patio in England. That's weird. We're out on like outdoor terrace. Anyways, we're out there and Schlenz walks by. He's getting milk for the family. And so we're like, well, come in for a beer, like come in for a pint. No, I can't. So I was saying, oh, I got to get this back. I got to do this and that. No, no, come on in. So he comes in, has one, has two. And then we get into it. And he's got the milk with him still. And he's well into it. And I don't know if any of you have seen Schlenz into it, but his nickname was Frank the Tank. You know, and self-proclaimed. Say, he called himself Frank the Tank. And so he was putting on a good show. And then Sarah, his now wife, is calling him, where's the milk? So we always have this joke that he took him 8 hours to bring home the milk. So that was one good one. But generally speaking, I mean, a lot of the stories are probably not good for a lot of people's ears, but we just had a good time, right? And no one was off limits. Tomo allowed us to really have a good time. I think he saw that the more we kind of built up our friendship and camaraderie, that it benefited us on the ice. And so he let us kind of just have at it with one another. So no, I don't really have many specific stories. There's lots of stories I could tell that probably aren't appropriate for the viewership.
Well, as you said, obviously you're seeing the guy, well, you're talking to the guys on Zoom and that, and you're on about a reunion. So maybe try and get a reunion in Coventry with the boys. You can tell, yeah. You can tell some stories. I'll have a word with the Blaze, see if they can put you up in the nice seats, and we'll have a chat.
They should. And then
I'll get you to re-sign my top from 16-year-old that don't fit me anymore.
Yeah, we'll put a couple extra panels in it so you can get into it.
That's it. That's it, Chris. Spot on.
Love it. That was brilliant. So, Chris, we're coming to the end of everything here now. We've asked every guest that we've had on this question. So it might be a tough one for you with some of the name drops you put at the beginning with your training camp. So we want you to pick your top six players you've played alongside. So that's one netminder, two D-men, and three forwards.
Ooh, good question. So the one netminder, I'd say, no disrespect to Jody Lehmann, who was excellent, would be Arthur Zerbe. He had a long NHL career, and then he got sent down. He was making $6 million US a year, and he got sent down to the American League. And he played with me for half a year and was just awesome. Great player, but also like treated the guys to dinners out, never let us pay for anything. Just a super team guy. Probably be the best goalie ever played on the ice with. Defenseman, play with a lot of good ones too that played in the NHL. But if I want to think about my experience not at the NHL level with camps, I would say I have to rank Neil up there pretty high. You know, he could do a little bit of everything. His skating was his best asset, but good leader. Again, logged a lot of minutes for us, played a huge role, but he'd be up there in terms of a defenseman. Again, because I was in an NHL camp, it's easy just to list NHL players, but I want to think about a mix of the two. I'd say beyond the elite league, I'd say, you know, I played with guys like Bruno St. Jack, who was a big NHL prospect. I played with Mike Commodore, played a lot of years in the NHL. Played with Wade Belak, you know, underestimated defensive ability. You know, he was just used as a utility guy to fight heavyweights, but I believe he could have played a role on an NHL team if he was given the opportunity. He was too tough to be given the opportunity. And then for forwards, I mean, I don't know if I play with a better duo than Calder and Carlson. I could say that in any given league. I've never seen two guys dominate a league more. were they the best players I ever played against? No, because I was at a training camp with Mary Lemieux and Alexei Kovalev. So that's not, I can't say they're that good. But the best duel I've ever played with, for sure, those guys. They were pretty impressive to watch that year. Really consistent and always found ways to contribute and score. So, yeah, that'd be my list if that works.
That's a quality list. I can't argue with it. I was thinking Neil's got to be in there at some point. I'm a bit of a Neil Martin fanboy. I'll be honest.
he was a popular guy, you know, and he was good in the community too, right? I think is part of what he did well. He's a nice guy. We're good buddies. Like I talked to Neil today, and he doesn't work for me anymore. He's carved out his own path, but he's done exceptionally well outside of hockey as well. And it's partly because of, you know, he's a good community guy, a good guy. People want to be around him, and he's a hardworking guy. So yeah, great player.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely one that's on our list to try and poach to get on. So
I can help you with that, no problem.
If you want to help with that, we'll put you down. Agent McNamara is on the case.
Yeah, there'll be a small broker fee, but I'll take that for Marty.
Quality. So no other questions from myself. I'll go around the guys now for you, Chris, and just see if they've got anything that's popped up while we've been talking. Sure. Ross, have you got anything?
No, nothing from me.
From Scott, any more from yourself?
No, I might apologise for being a bit of a fanboy tonight. Obviously, going back to my teenage years and how I was a little obsessed with you as a fan. Not in a weird way, but you know, like yeah, just no, to
good to know.
Just to get to talk to you tonight, Chris. It's been a pleasure, and I appreciate that.
Oh, thanks. No, it's been a pleasure, guys. I appreciate it.
The problem is that Ash, have you got any more?
Nothing more for me. I'm sat here literally living the proverbial dream. I feel like that 16-year-old kid again, watching Blazewing Grand Slams. This has been absolutely unbelievable.
Great. No, I've enjoyed it, guys. I love going down memory lane because, again, it was such a fond year for me. And your job now is to create enough groundswell back in Coventry to get all the boys back for a reunion. Let's see what we can do.
Oh yeah, definitely. We'll put this out there, and I'm sure some of the old fan base will be up on it, and that will probably entice the guys to join up again. So all I can say, Chris, is thank you for joining us on this trip down memory lane. Like you've just put yourself, you know, there's some real good memories in there, some for us, some for you that we weren't aware of, that have just had us in stitches when we've been muted off mic. So they've been absolutely brilliant. So thank you, Chris, for joining us. And to everybody that's listening, thank you for listening to this week's episode. And again, Happy New Year. We hope you've had a good Christmas holiday. And we hope soon we'll be back in some sort of an ice rink to watch some sort of hockey. And we hope to hear from you all soon. Cheers.
Thanks again for listening to the Third Period Podcast. We hope you enjoyed the show. Remember to check out Willie's Ice Hockey Emporium for all your ice hockey needs.